Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, it is the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, freedom, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, skepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And I'll hand you over to Neil Denny to introduce this week's guest.
Thanks, Padraig. Our guest tonight is the writer Howard Jacobson. Howard is a writer of both non-fiction and novels and a journalist with a regular column in The Independent. He has described himself as a Jewish Jane Austen and is often described as a British Philip Roth by others. Howard's novels include Coming From Behind, No More Mr. Nice Guy and The Mighty Waltzer. His most recent novel is Kaluki Nights, which we'll be talking about tonight, which he describes as the most Jewish novel that has ever been written by anybody anywhere. Two of Howard's non-fiction books, Roots, Schmoots and Seriously Funny, have been made into television series. Howard, thank you very much for joining us on Little Atoms.
Thank you for asking me. Lovely to be here.
I'm going to ask you why a Jewish Jane Austen first, I think.
This is the bloody internet. You say something
Wikipedia.
In some literary festival which goes down a storm because it's not what they expect you to say, and then it follows you around like a tin can tied to a dog forever. But I tell you, you mentioned Jane Austen and Philip Roth together, and an American writer, Kevin Sessoms, who writes for Vanity Fair, heard me talking in Toronto. We were both talking at the harbour front, and he heard this Jane Austen thing, and he looked at me and he thought, Jane Austen. And he heard this Philip Roth thing, and he said, no, what you actually are is you're what would have been produced had Philip Roth and Jane Austen slept together. So that's who I am. I am the love child of Philip Roth and Jane Austen.
Okay, well Jane's going to feature in my next question as well. We'll get on to Kaluki Nights in a while, as I mentioned, but I want to talk first about there's an article you wrote for The Independent quite recently where you brought up, I don't know where this actually comes from, it must have been some sort of survey, but there's been something done that says that men are not reading novels anymore, they're more likely to read non-fiction and history, and that, if I can quote you in saying that, basically people are suggesting that Jane Austen was pissing in the breeze writing about balls in country houses when she should have been addressing the Napoleonic Wars. And obviously you disagree with this.
I do,
I do. I'd like to talk about why the novel is important to our imagination then, and why.
Well, I mean, there's a good place to start, mm-hmm. because in real daily life, we think the Napoleonic Wars are much more important than a ball or a tea party in Bath. We think what's going on in Iraq is much more important than what we might be doing in a restaurant in Soho. And that might be the case in as far as our workaday, judgmental, municipal selves are concerned. And what's wonderful about the novel is it takes you out of that and says nothing in the novel is a priori more important than anything else. You can't gain seriousness in a novel because you talk about a serious thing. You can write a trivial novel about the war in Iraq, and you can write a profound novel about taking tea in Bath. And that's one of the reasons I think that the novel is so important, that it throws everything up in the air and everything has to start again. Everything has to win its own seriousness. And it wins its own seriousness partly through language. Mm-hmm. A thing is only serious because the language in which you discuss it, in art, that is. The form in which you discuss a thing in art, whether it's the paint that you use or the words that you use or the notes that you use, they determine whether a thing has vitality or any significance or any moment. And that's wonderful because it means it's all down to the art to confer significance. Nothing comes from the outside.
In that significance, is there a duty on the novelist or even on any artist to challenge? Must there always be a challenge to the reader?
Well, we think so now. We glamorize art now. As art has got less and less influence, we glamorize it more, I think, as it gets pushed more and more to the margins mm-hmm. of life. And it is being pushed more and more to the margins of life, although we think, isn't it wonderful, lots of people go to Tate Modern and the rest of it. My own belief is that a lot of the people who are reading, who are going to the Tate Modern, are like a lot of the people who are going to the bookshops and buying 3-for-2 chiclet. It's not art that they're getting some other experience, the experience of being around art,
yes.
But it's not art itself. So I think art is at the margins of our life more and more now, and so it's possible that we glamorize it and we think the margins are where we belong, and therefore we are of necessity rebels. You know, we are riding, and I glamorize myself like that. I'm out riding out on the frontier. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Jane Austen would have felt like that most of the time when she was writing. Norman Mailer said somewhere or other, you know, the duty of every artist is to offend. That would have been a strange thing for Jane Austen to have heard. Probably even a strange thing for George Eliot to have heard. It goes with our time, and I think it's a strong sign and also a weak sign that we are fighting to be heard. But it might be that in a time when art is not being attended to properly, that one of the things that that people who make art have to do is to shake people around a lot. I certainly see my role like that. That my role is just to upset, really, and to discomfort and to make life difficult. And whenever I go to a book club or something or other, and people show me that they've, when they're not showering with praise, which is the bit I like, when they are complaining and saying, you know, this is an uncomfortable read, or I don't like the hero, or I get at first furious and then delighted because it means I have done the job.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned marginality. Does that, in your opinion, tie into, well, Jewishness, really? I mean, as a writer yourself, do the two kind of come together?
Well, they do a bit, because I think Jews take the making of art more seriously than anyone. Mm-hmm. Jewish artists, I mean, Jewish painters are fantastically serious and fretful and always have been intensely solemn and serious about their art. Jewish novelists, too. Jewish novelists tend to be funny. The novel, the intimate mode, suits well the making of jokes, and Jews like making jokes. So, you know, the Jewish novel is often Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, me, Isaac Bashevis Singer. They attain their seriousness, their intense seriousness, via comedy often. But the reason for this seriousness, I think, is that earlier injunction in one of the commandments that you must not make any graven image. And although a novel is not, strictly speaking, a graven image any more than a play is, I think Jews have taken the whole business of making art to be something that they were told not to do. So that when they do it with an immense sense of responsibility and even a sense of possible blasphemy. You're taking on God. When you write a novel, you're remaking the world. In other words, you are saying the way God made the world is not satisfactory. If you were satisfied with the way God made the world, you would not bother writing a novel. You'd go out and play and do what all the people who are satisfied with life do. You play football or something. So you become, you make art or something like art, I think, when you experience an intense dissatisfaction with life and therefore with God. Therefore, you're standing toe-to-toe with God. So you're doing a big thing. So the seriousness of art and the blasphemy of art and that sense of therefore being outside creation, if you like. I mean, you're almost of the devil's party. You and Satan are having the same argument with God. So, yes, is the answer to your question, I think.
Well, I'd like to go back to, you mentioned Norman Mailer, and the article I sort of brought up at the beginning was about Norman Mailer and his recent death. And going back to the idea about the responsibilities of the author, if any, does the ideas we put on authors having... What am I trying to say? Does this excuse their behaviour in some sort of way? Because Norman Mailer was, as well as being a great author, was, and you know him, so forgive me for this, but he was something of a shit in his personal
life. I think that's
life.
Entirely and completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Fun to talk about, you know, we can have fun to talk about, but it bears no relation to the work made whatsoever. None. Insofar as the responsibility of the artist is concerned, certainly anyway, the responsibility of the novelist, I think, is to be irresponsible. It is an irresponsible form, and you do what you want with it. And the more you upset, the better, I think. I'm not saying you are obliged to upset. You can calm. There are novels which you read because they calm or confirm you, but they're not as much fun, I think, and they don't really do the job as well as those novels which derange you and unsettle you and so on. But I think what you do, what Norman Mailer does in his private life, or what I or anybody, my private life, is, as it turns out, is spotless. But even if it were not, it would not be anybody's business, really. It's completely irrelevant, I think.
Well, how far do you take that? I mean, obviously you're talking about the private life, but a author obviously has a public life as well. And if we... Okay, let's take it to the most ridiculous extreme and say, if... Will people still be reading Stalin's light romantic novels if he'd written them.
Well,
or something.
He actually did write light romantic novels, didn't he?
Well, you wouldn't read them because they're light romantic novels. I mean, we shouldn't be reading. But if they wrote a serious comic novel of the kind that I approve, then I would certainly read them. I mean, you get take a novelist like Céline, who was an anti-Semitic shit. Mm-hmm. That makes no difference. You read the novels. Houellebecq has some atrocious ideas, sure. We might say, but we read the novel. But of course, there may be a moment when the atrociousness of the idea starts to bleed into the work. Mm-hmm. And what would offend you then is not the fact that that there is atrociousness. Atrociousness in a novel is fine. But if you feel that the novelist is peddling some, say, Stalinistic or fascistic stuff on you through the novel, then of course the novel is not going to work, because the novel then becomes ideological or pedantic. So it is part of the novelist's job never to peddle an ideology. End of novel if it's ideological. So if you're Stalin or you're Mussolini or you're Hitler and you're writing a novel, the first thing you have to do is to overcome what you happen to believe. And that would be very difficult for them to do. And for them to have done it would have been an extraordinary intellectual, let alone moral act, and also an extraordinarily aesthetic act. And if Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin had been capable of that aesthetic leap, how much one would love to read the book. They really are, though.
Okay, well, with that question, then, I've already gone from the sublime to the ridiculous, to a ridiculous extreme.
Sorry, have I taken you to the... I thought I was staying sublime.
Well, I was going to... in some people's view, would take that even further down now and bring up the personage of Bernard Manning, who you've written about numerous times in the past. And I want to bring in your... Seriously Funny, the non-fiction book that you've written about the sort of importance of comedy, and I'd like to sort of talk about some of those ideas. Bernard Manning is the personification of all that is unacceptable to the liberals, basically. I was going to say the liberal left, but to anybody really. But you've put across some quite interesting defensive, not of him, but of just the use of humour of his sort. So perhaps we could talk about that.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about Bernard Manning is he was a test case for Sir Chubby Brown is the other one. Mm-hmm. When I was writing my comedy book, and indeed making a television series that went with it, and the television series upset people from the start. I, if you like, made the mistake of going straight in boots and all with Chubby Brown and Bernard Manning, and that did upset people, because these are unacceptable comedians. You can't have an unacceptable comedian. You can have a funny comedian or an unfunny comedian. There is no other judgment you can make. It's these, because a comedian is also an artist, and the decision, the judgment that you make has got to be an aesthetic judgment or nothing else. It is a cliche of comedy that, you know, we're meant to offend, we're meant to break the barriers. The stand-up comics all said, you know, the previous comedians of the 50s and the 60s had been safe, you know, ordinary comedians for middle or working class families, and we were going to be with Ben Elton, we were going to break down the barriers and we were going to wake people up. In comes Bernard Manning, and we go, oh, but we can't have it done like that. And what was so interesting about that was that you'd get people like Ben Elton, who were, as it were, talking from the people, comrades, he would say, whereas, of course, it was absolutely middle-class university comedy. The real comedy of the people, if you wanted to see comedy from the people, was Bernard Manning and Chubby Brown. You'd go to their club, you'd go to Bernard Manning's club or Chubby Brown at the pier in Blackpool, and you'd see working-class people having the time of their lives, enjoying comedy, doing what comedy does, often being offensive because there's a great joy in being offensive, breaking taboos, there's a great joy in breaking taboos, getting things out of them, out of themselves. I mean, nobody ever believed me, but I used to stand outside the audience and look at the audiences leaving, and you would see a kind of transfiguration. I don't say they left like angels, that's not what comedy did, but it got a lot of the poison out of their system. Mm-hmm. And it is, and comedy, this is not the only justification for them, but one of the ways that comedy works is to cleanse the system, if you like. You laugh at the things you should not laugh at. All societies have known this, and the most conventional societies have known it best. You have it in a Catholic societies, you have carnival. In societies, in Pueblo societies, in New Mexico, which are very, very conservative, ancient religion plus with an overlay of Catholicism, very, very conservative societies, they have the filthiest clowns you can imagine, who pretend to rape old ladies, who throw excrement over one another. You have to have somewhere this moment in which you break everything that you believe in. And then, conservatively, it's true, you go back to where you were before. I think Bernard Manning provided that function. And if it made us uneasy, and if he said things that we felt should not be said, that's what he is for.
So the point of say laughing at Bernard Manning is that you're laughing at the transgression rather than the possible or otherwise opinion. It's the transgression is the key.
Well, you're doing that, but I mean, I would be untrue to my own argument if I said it's only that. You are partly mm-hmm. doing it. I think you could show that several of Bernard Manning's jokes.
Yeah.
A joke is like a little novel, and I think. And just as in a little novel, the narrator is not necessarily the voice that you trust. The narrator is, you are meant to mm-hmm. see the narrator in a dramatic context, and the narrator is not always, we all know that. The narrator is not saying what the novel believes. The narrator might be saying the very opposite to what the novel believes. So in a joke, the narrator is often the butt of his own joke. And I definitely saw with my own eyes and heard with my own ears Bernard Manning making jokes in which his own racism was the butt of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't only that. He also enjoyed racist comedy. And the audience enjoyed laughing at that which, most of the time, they knew they should not be allowed to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I can't let them off. If I let them off, then I weaken my own argument about it. Comedy is a place where you go, some of the time, to be absolutely vile. Because if you're not going to be vile there, where are you going to be vile? And if your answer to that is, well, we don't have to be vile at all, it's human nature we're dealing with here.
Do you think there should be any limits? I mean, there's just a couple of days ago on the Guardian's Commentaries Free site, the philosopher A.C. Grayling wrote an article about this free speech and about how, you know, vital it was and we should be standing up for it. And even in that, an extremely strong article of pro-freedom of speech, he very much comes down on the side that there are certain things that, obviously, you know, we criticise religion on this programme and people's politics, and these sort of things are ideas, but there are things like disabilities or a person's sexuality or race or things like that that they can't do anything about. These are not dogmatic things. Do you think that there are things that we should avoid just because there's nothing people can do to change them?
A.C. Grayling sounds right. He's usually right. I have immense admiration for A.C. Grayling. And that sounds right. It's a hard one, this one, because there's a part of me that wants to say anything is possible. And I know I set out as a writer and I do say things which I know offend some. I don't say. The novel plays with ideas which some people find offensive. And I say most of the time, tough, if you can't take it, you know, read something else, read Harry Potter, if that's the best that you can do. But it's also the case that I censor myself, that and I make an aesthetic decision as to where, because actual studied bad taste, showy offy bad taste, demonstrable bad taste, can be aesthetically very corny. You can tell when someone's trying too hard. Mm-hmm. The aesthetic law helps you. You know, I use the aesthetics before I use any other judgment. It won't sound right. It won't pace right. It won't feel right. It won't write right. But where that, but where a comedian is concerned, or where, then I think there are. It's aesthetics too, but it's also some of those things which we practice in our private life. We can't forget that, you know, that if someone has just died, we don't go knocking on their relative's door and making jokes about death. We don't do that. On the other hand, one thinks of, you know, that terrifically funny and, you know, utterly, utterly vile, funny record that Peter Cook and Dudley Moore mm-hmm. made, where they, you know, they make cancer jokes. They do that, you know, they do that, the C word, and they go where you feel you shouldn't go. But you also don't believe they would do that to someone who's...
Yeah.
So then the minute you say that, then you have to admit that there is always a limit. There is always a limit to determined by, I think, aesthetics and also by tact and also by timing. And it depends how good your ear is. I mean, a good ear gets you through. That's why mm-hmm. I say aesthetics.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should probably get on to Kaluki Nights, really, as we've got 10 minutes left, and that covers some of the themes that we talk about. Really, it's a book that's moving and it's tragic, but it's also incredibly funny. But it's funny about things that one would not ordinarily think we should be humorous about. So, tell us what it's about.
I find it very difficult to tell people what it's about because I'm never really sure what it's about. I love it when I get good reviews, and one of them was from A.C. Grayling, hence my immense admiration for A.C. Grayling. And he explained to me partly what the book was about in a way that I thought was terrific. I find that very helpful. It is essentially about I always talk about these things in the abstract. I want to talk about forgetfulness and how we mustn't forget and bearing and memory and those things. But, of course, that's not helpful. It's about three boys, three Jewish boys who grow up in Manchester in the 1950s and are presented with, because we were all presented with in real life at that time, a book called The Scourge of the Swastika, which was the first account by Lord Russell of Liverpool of the Holocaust and what had happened. First, we got to hear of it. And in a way, it's as if the book, the novel, looks at the possibility that this, the reading of this book could have so profoundly affected the lives of these boys as to have certainly changed, possibly ruined, possibly damaged, certainly hurt the lives of some of these boys, all of these boys in different ways. So it then becomes a book about the burden of memory and the burden of being Jewish, and then it becomes, you know, is Jewishness almost a tragic burden that Jews must bear, and which then takes you to, you know, the way other people feel about Jewishness, the way non-Jews feel about Jewishness. So it becomes an argument about the reason I said, again, another of these things that got caught up on the internet, the most Jewish book that's ever been written, which I actually said in a talk before I'd finished the book, and I just said somewhere, I am at the moment writing what could be the most Jewish book. It's got no meaning, that sentence, but anyway, I'm stuck with it. But that was what I meant by it, that it just took on the whole Jewish thing, what it's like to be Jewish, what we should be if we're Jewish. It takes on the fights between Orthodox Jewishness and secularity. I am a great propagandist out of the novel for, you know, secular Judaism. I love being Jewish, but I've got no interest in following rules or going to the synagogue or anything. I mean, I like the whole, for me, being Jewish is about trying to be as ethical as you can possibly be. It's about using your intelligence. Freud said that the whole point about being Jewish was that the Jews made at a very early period a leap for the ethical life as against the sensual life. And that's one of the reasons that we are hated so much, because people fear the ethical life, and they also fear that we, the Jews, have ratted upon the sensual life, and some, which is why often, you know, when you get pagan, when you get anti-Semitism, often takes a pagan form. So you get, you know, it goes with the Germans having pagan festivals and carnivals and naked women going through the streets and people enjoying a vast bodily festival that they should not, like Jews. It goes, so it takes on all this, takes on anti-Semitism, it takes on Holocaust denial, because while I was writing the novel, there was a lot of Holocaust denial in the air. And God, who loves novelists, although we are blasphemers, the Jewish God loves a dispute, so he loves novelists. And God sent me a real-life Holocaust denier. I actually met one and had the Holocaust denied to me in an English garden party on a sunny afternoon. Beautiful woman in a hat. It was the eeriest experience of my life. That was terrific. So I could go back to my, listen to what she said, go back to my desk. And it was there that I conceived the notion that Holocaust deniers suffer a terrible doom. I'm not going to tell you who it was, but you're mouthing the right name. The Holocaust deniers, like all anti-Semites, suffer this terrible doom, that they are doomed for the rest of their lives to be interested in nothing but Jewishness. She knew so much about Jewishness. She knew every Jew. She knew all the books of the Talmud. She knew everything about, you know, what rabbinic commentaries had made. So there she, and she can't leave it alone. So there she is, hating Jews, although she wouldn't admit that. I let it out that it was a she. Oh, no, I've already told you that it was a she. Yes. And there she is denying the Holocaust, which means she has to go from concentration camp to concentration camp with a ruler and a set square, measuring the spaces to show that you couldn't have killed 1 million every hour there and all that stuff. So her life is consumed with Jewishness. And I loved that. I thought there was a Dantesque quality of punishment. That's her punishment. Well, forever, reading about Jews.
You also, I mean, in a similar vein, presumably all of these people that are denying the Holocaust are anti-Semitic and therefore want Jews dead. So it's strange that they're sort of denying the greatest triumph that they've ever had.
Yes,
really.
I think that's completely fascinating, because you never get one that doesn't imply, you know, it didn't happen, and in brackets, what shame it didn't happen. So, yeah, and you're right, they are denying their greatest of all triumphs. Funny, that illogical.
Going back to, well, we talked about the limits of humour. Do you think there are limits about what can be written about at all? Because there's some incredible sequences in the book. There's fantasy sequences where one of the characters is fantasising about the wife of the commandant of the camp. And
yes.
And it's...
Well, there were some famous sadistic women, famously sadistic women, who we read about in the 1950s in Lord Russell of Liverpool's book, and there were photographs of them and descriptions about what they did to Jewish men in the camps. And what they did to Jewish men was of a sexual nature. And there's no way you can read that when you're 14 and not have it mess around with your sexuality. And I simply wanted to honour that too, that is also the burden that you bear. But insofar as, you know, people have said, my God, this is a book about the Holocaust, but it's also funny. It's not funny about the Holocaust. It certainly doesn't make light of the Holocaust. In fact, what I was doing was I hate that idea of employing comedy, but the comic mode enabled me, I felt, that was my ambition anyway, to give the due weight to the Holocaust. Because if we're going to deal with it now, as people who have not lived through it ourselves, moment by moment, we have to employ all our resources to think about it. And all our resources include our sense of humour, which is part of our sense of intelligence. So I think to exclude that and think we can only be solemn and tiptoe around it is to deny the best of our minds, the best part of our minds, in dealing with the most horrible thing that's ever happened.
I think that's as good a note as any to end it on. Harry Jacobson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back next week.
Thank you very much.